thinking 3 minutes in perspective, in December 2009, when we discovered the amplitude of the numbers of the Greek deficit and indebtedness, which supposedly wasn't known by Eurostat before, Mrs. Merkel said, "This is not a problem for Europe, this is not a problem for the euro, it's a problem for the Greeks." Almost 3 years after, yesterday, Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, was still arguing whether he was prepared to take some losses on the Greek bonds that eventually he bought in the 2008 and 2009 period. The ECB balance sheet blew up from 500 to 3 trillion euros, and is well on its way to get to 4 if they do what they say they would do, which is to buy Spanish and Italian bonds, which, by the way, they haven't started doing. Markets are optimistic that they will do so, which is true. Nobody knows how much, nobody knows when, but a little bit of optimism is helpful. To discuss that, I'm going first to introduce Marshall Oba. Oh, you're sorry, it's you first. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, because we're sorry. Yannis, he's a real professor. He's a professor of economics. He teaches economic theory at the University of Athens. He's a visiting professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson Graduate School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. And he is also the in-house economist with Valve, or Valve software. I'm sure we'll talk to you about that. But more interestingly, basically, he is guilty because he was advising the president, the prime minister of Greece, George Papandreou, until 2007, and the crisis happened just after he left. So he has not only a theoretical view, but he's been in the trenches of the Greek situation. I'm sure that what he has to tell us is going to be totally fascinating. So, Yannis, sorry for missing your first step, but
that's okay.
We are very happy that you're here and very interested in listening to your part of the story.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, George, for the introduction. Yes, I'm guilty as charged. My only defense is that after I stopped advising George Papandreou, firstly, he won the election, which he hadn't done when I was advising him. And secondly, after he won the election, I turned into an ardent critic of his government. Greece is not important enough to be occupying the headlines around the world for 3 years. Imagine a situation where a crisis in the state of Delaware was threatening to bring the United States of America down. If that happened, then the problem would not be with Delaware. It would have been with the United States of America. Let me not beat about the bush, ladies and gentlemen. The Eurozone is disintegrating. And I shall just call upon Exhibit A without the B or C to follow. 1 euro in a Greek bank account has a much lower present value, expected value, than 1 euro in an Italian account. And a euro in an Italian account has a lower expected value than a euro in a Parisian bank account, which has a lower present value than a euro in a German bank account. In Nevada, which is, from what I hear, badly hit by the 2008 crisis, $1 in a Nevadan bank account is exactly the same present value as $1 in a New York State bank account. And that tells the story. Now, hindsight is not a very good guide to the truth. Most of my Anglo-Saxon friends, colleagues, academics, journalists, utilizing the benefit of hindsight, turn around and say to me, "Well, what did you expect? You Europeans had the audacity of binding together such disparate economies in one currency union. Did you expect it to work?" Well, it didn't work, but that's not because it could not have worked. Come to think of it, take the United States of America again. It is a union of very disparate economies. The economy of Missouri and the economy of California are just as different as the economy of Portugal and the economy of France or Germany. Indeed, within Germany, before the Eurozone was created and after, you will find that there are many regions that are totally at odds with one another. Bavaria and the eastern states of Germany, for instance. Very different economies, different vitality, different degree of capital accumulation. To put it differently, every country, every currency union, because the United States is a currency union, Britain is a currency union, indeed Germany was a currency union before the euro, comprises surplus regions and deficit regions. Take the United Kingdom, for instance. Yorkshire is always going to be in deficit to London, and Wales is always going to be in deficit vis-a-vis England. And yet these currency unions do not give rise to crises which lead the English to saying that the Welsh must be thrown out of the United Kingdom, or the people of Missouri will have to pack up the bags and leave the United States of America. Now, there are, of course, political and social and cultural reasons why that doesn't happen. But the reason why we have a very different situation in the Eurozone is completely, utterly economic. And it has to do with the way we trade. And clues to the problems that we have in Europe now can be sought quite profitably in the 1920s. Because the 1920s were typified by a common currency of that era. It was a gold standard. The gold standard's significance in this context is that it bound together different currencies in fixed exchange rates with gold and with one another, creating effectively a single currency. It could be, of course, that it was, of course, that you know the French had the franc and the Germans had the mark and the Americans had the dollar, and yet these were locked into one another in a fixed way and vis-a-vis gold. So effectively, the capitalist world in the 20s was operating as if under the same currency. The end of the 1920s saw the crash of 1929, a financial implosion which began in Wall Street. And what was the first thing that happened? The first thing that happened was infection of Main Street from Wall Street and a very quick disintegration of the common currency of the era, the gold standard. It was indeed Roosevelt's great move, the first thing that he did to get the United States out of the gold standard and follow Britain down that road. The country that didn't do it and was hanging on for dear life within the gold standard was Holland, and it had the worst impact of the Great Depression. Now, the lesson from this part of our common history is that if you try to create a common currency, a fixed exchange regime, more or less the same thing, from an economic point of view, and you lack a way of balancing or recycling, as I'd like to say, the deficits of the deficit regions with the surplus of the surplus regions, then those regions are going to start shifting under the weight of the surpluses and the deficits that increase, and like tectonic plates, eventually they will create the circumstances for an earthquake, like they did in 1929. In the United States of America, there is a common currency binding the different states together, but there is also a surplus recycling mechanism, actually various surplus recycling mechanisms. Let me just give you a couple of examples. I could give a lot more. When in 2008 we had the crash here in New York, in Wall Street, immediately the state of Nevada faced a major, major recession which had to do with the bursting of the bubble in the real estate there. Now imagine what would have happened if the state of Nevada had to bail out the banks state domiciled in Nevada. And also, if the state of Nevada had to borrow internationally without access to printing presses in order to pay for the unemployment benefits for a population whose unemployment rate was skyrocketing. What would happen is this. The banks of Nevada and the state of Nevada would have sunk without a trace, hugging each other like two very weak swimmers in stormy waters. This is what's happening in the Eurozone. So the fact that it's taxes in New York and in California that help ameliorate the problem of paying unemployment benefits in Nevada is a form of surplus recycling. Let me give you a second example, because I promised two. When Boeing gets a contract from the Pentagon to build a new fighter jet or whatever, drones, I don't know what, one of the conditions for that contract is that new production facilities are going to be built in Minnesota, in Missouri, in Tennessee, in Arizona, in the deficit regions. This is not an act of philanthropy on the part of the Pentagon towards the deficit regions of the United States. It's just pragmatic economics. Because only by building a production facility in a deficit state do you create, in that deficit state, a flow of income. People get jobs and start working. They're not getting benefits. They're getting income from productive activity. And then they can keep buying goods and services from California and from New York State, from the surplus states, so as to maintain the flow of economic activity that allows California to maintain its surpluses vis-a-vis Arizona. California is always going to have a surplus vis-a-vis Arizona. So these surplus recycling mechanisms, and there are various such mechanisms, are essential for keeping the union going. So to my Anglo-Saxon, particularly British Eurosceptic friends, I say the fact that we brought together disparate countries under the same currency is not the problem per se. The problem is that we did it in a gold standard fashion without a surplus recycling mechanism, hoping that it would float. After the war, the United States of America emerged as the only serious surplus-producing country following the human catastrophe of the Second World War in Europe, in Japan, everywhere. In the Bretton Woods Conference, Britain and the United States, particularly, had agreed on one thing. They want to reconstitute a form of the gold standard, fixed exchange rates. That was the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates, where the dollar was the only currency which was convertible with gold, but all the other currencies were fixed in their exchange rates vis-a-vis the dollar. But they had learned the lesson of the past, and they were quite determined to have a surplus recycling mechanism within this Bretton Woods international system. Where they disagreed, John Maynard Keynes was the representative of the Brits in Bretton Woods, was in Keynes's determination to establish that surplus recycling mechanism formally, to create an international system, he called it an international clearing union, that would transparently and as a result of institutional hard work ensure that surpluses are redistributed as productive investments or flows into the deficit countries in order to keep the Bretton Woods system, the post-war, if you want, gold standard, revamped, going, and to avoid a new 1929. The United States of America at the time, being the surplus producer, had a slightly different idea. They did not disagree with the concept that surplus recycling had to take place, but they just wanted to do it themselves. It was our surplus, we're going to distribute it any way we want, and we're not going to do it in the context of a multilateral international institution. Which is precisely what they did. The Marshall Plan is part of that story. But not just the Marshall Plan. For 15, 20 years, the United States of America was recycling a significant part of its surplus towards Germany and Japan, trying to prop up these two major economies in order to create currencies that were internationally successful and powerful, so as to create shock absorbers in case the American economy went into another recession, and the fear would then be that without any other powerful regions within the capitalist world, the Soviet Union or some kind of sharp recession would jeopardize the prospects of world capitalism. This is how the Bretton Woods system worked, and how the gold era of capitalism in the 1950s and 60s was founded. It died in 1971, famously on the 15th of August of 1971 when President Nixon announced the end of it. Why did he die? Because by the end of the 1960s, the United States of America no longer had a surplus. So how can you recycle a surplus if you don't have it? And then something quite remarkable happened. We entered the second period, a weird and wonderful second post-war phase, during which American hegemony and dominance was founded on a reversal of the flows of capital and goods. To put it bluntly, and I shall quote from Paul Volcker's famous 1971 brief to Henry Kissinger, if we can't recycle our surpluses, we will recycle other people's surpluses. Which is precisely what happened between the 1970s and 2008. The United States of America operated like a huge vacuum cleaner, sucking into this land the net exports of Germany, of Japan, and later of China, ever-increasing deficits, trade deficits, were registered, but that was not a fault, it was part of the design. And who was paying for those deficits? Well, those deficits were being financed by a tsunami of capital that was flowing from Germany, from Japan, and later from China, back into the United States through Wall Street. Why? Because the profits that the Germans, the Japanese, the Saudis, the Russians later, the Chinese were making, found better returns in Wall Street. This is a big story as to how that was accomplished, but this is what was going on. This reversal of the surplus recycling. During Bretton Woods, we had America recycling its own surpluses. Now we have America recycling everybody else's surpluses, utilizing its own deficits as the locomotive that did it. That was the setting in which the Eurozone was born. The Eurozone is a child of this very weird and strange system of hegemony, where the hegemon is basing his or hers, her hegemony on deficits. During that era of the reversed flow of deficits and surpluses, still a surplus recycling mechanism, German capital, capital goods, machinery, was helping capitalize Europe. Throughout the breadth and width of the European continent, you will find somewhere Siemens or IG or some large German manufacturer having provided the infrastructure. Yet, Germany was never Europe's locomotive. The periphery of Europe provided Germany with the demand it needed to keep its export-oriented growth going. Germany was effectively was a net exporter of capital and consumption goods to the rest of Europe and a net importer of aggregate demand, demand for those goods. The good, the products of the manufacturing sector. But to allow the Euro, what is now the Eurozone, back then the European Common Market, to function as if in equilibrium in that manner, it was essential that the United States of America continue to create demand for the whole of Europe through this vacuum cleaner that was sucking net exports both from Europe and Asia into the United States of America. Germany was utilizing the rest of Europe as a vital space that provided with the demand which was necessary for the accumulation of German surpluses that were in turn helping Germany globalize. German corporations globalize both here in the United States and in China later on. There was a threat to this process. The German interest was very well aware, and so were German policymakers. The threat was coming from what we economists refer to as competitive devaluation, and I'll give you a very simple example. When Fiat found it hard to sell cars in Germany because Volkswagen's technological innovations were faster, their factories were more efficient, and so on and so forth, the Bank of Italy, the Central Bank of Italy, would engineer a devaluation of the Italian lira vis-a-vis the German Deutschmark. And suddenly, Fiats were competitive again. This was a threat to the strategy of globalizing German corporations and building German surpluses by utilizing demand that was imported into Germany from the rest of Europe. It was something that German policymakers were very keen to undo. This is the framework in which the Eurozone, the idea of a common currency, emerged. Why did the European elites want to create the Eurozone? Each one of them for different reasons. The German elites had as a primary concern competitive devaluation. This is why they initially started the idea of an exchange rate mechanism that would limit the fluctuations of exchange rates within Europe. When that failed, they were prepared to go one step further towards a common currency. The French elites had a different idea. They had a variety of motives towards a currency union. Firstly, you have to remember that French trade unions were always quite uppity and quite energetic. And unlike German trade unions, were not interested in a corporatist settlement, but they were going for high wage rates and wage growth. Secondly, the German elites were very keen to use the comparative advantage that France had in the financial sector vis-à-vis Germany. Germany was a powerhouse industrially, but French banks were far more globalized, far more advanced than the equivalent German banks. And the French elites thought that by binding together Germany and France, not only would French labor be subdued, but also the French banking system would effectively take over the financing of continental Europe. And thirdly, equally importantly, from the perspective of the French elites, the French are very good at administering things. Look at the OECD, look at the way that the Marshall Plan was administered, look at Brussels. Look at the way in which the European Union is being run. The Germans cannot even provide, even though they have the power to impose, a president of the European Central Bank. They just don't have good enough apparatchiks to do the job. So this, let's go to Italy and to my country. Why did the Greek elites want to join a common currency? Simply because they had enough with inflation. Because inflation, competitive devaluations of the lira, of the drachma, were creating inflation, which was eaten into the store of value of the well-off in our countries. Our workers, at the same time, had also had enough of inflation because their hard-won battles on the industrial field, strikes and so on, were very quickly reversed by an acceleration of inflation, so the higher wages in the end meant nothing. So there were many different motives for creating the Eurozone. But the Eurozone was created along the lines of the gold standard of the pre-1929 era, not along the lines of the Bretton Woods era. There was no surplus recycling mechanism. Come to think of it, during the run-up to the creation of the euro, to get into the Eurozone, a country like mine, or Italy, had effectively to accept a slow-burning recession in its real economy, in its industry, in its farming, in the sectors of the economy where real material goods are being produced. If you look at industrial data, not overall national income data, you'll find that the price that our countries in the periphery of Europe paid to get into the Eurozone was effectively shrinkage. It was the only way by which to achieve the lower rates of inflation that were necessary in order to get into the Eurozone. Now, some people, many commentators, argue that Europe created those rules called the Maastricht Treaty for getting into the Eurozone that put certain limits on the amount of indebtedness of states, 60% of GDP, and 3% of GDP in terms of deficits, in order to be allowed into the euro. But then they allowed countries like Italy, that had 120% of GDP in debt, to get in. So this was an error caused by optimism and by political pressure. Well, it was not an error. if I'm right in my hypothesis that competitive devaluation, especially vis-à-vis Italy, was an essential motive for Germany to accept a transition from the Deutschmark to the euro, then Italy had to be in. And do you know how Greece got in? I'll tell you, because friends of mine actually engineered it. What they did was they copied exactly what Italy did in order to do a makeover on our statistics. You know, you've heard of Greek statistics. They are Italian statistics and French statistics. The Greeks are not inventive enough to create their own means of manipulating the data. My mates at the University of Athens, who also worked at the Ministry of Finance at the time, simply copied exactly what the Italians did. They then got evidence that this is what the Italians did. And then they said to the Europeans, look, we've done what they did. If you don't let us in, we will expose you. And we will simply ask the question, why is Italy allowed in when they've done exactly the same thing? Not to mention Germany, of course, right? Did you know that at some point Germany valued the gold held by the Bundesbank and counted it as an income of the German state so as to reduce the nominal deficit? Now, if Greece had done that, you know what we've been hearing about it. Anyway, the Eurozone is thus created. And what we have is a period of 8 years, between 2000 and 2008, of low lethargic German growth in national income. Much lower than my country's. My country was growing at 4 and 5% when Germany was barely growing at 1%. Compared to France, Germany was growing at a slower rate. Its prices were growing at a slower rate. But at the same time, investment was growing much faster. German reunification had unleashed a very large amount, number, if you want, of workers. A pool of labor was discovered as if, and it was not just in East Germany, because with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain, Slovakia opened up to German industry, the Czech Republic, Poland, and that squeezed real wages in Germany and real wages that German industry had to pay beyond belief. These were the changes that made, between 2000 and 2008, German industry far more competitive, creating a divergence in competitiveness within the Eurozone. The rest of Europe, even France, was experiencing this slow-burning recession which was necessary in order to enter into the Eurozone, and then after the creation of the Eurozone, was rewarded effectively by a very large flow of capital. Our productive capacities were shrinking relative to those of Germany, but our income was rising. Why? Because we had all this capital flowing in. And where did that capital come from? Two sources. Private money minted by Wall Street banks and the City of London, also known as derivatives, that were creating tsunamis effectively of private money, which then had to go somewhere to find high returns, and they took the risk of coming into my country, into Ireland, into Spain, creating bubbles in the real estate sector, in the public sector in my country. And the second source of capital that was flowing into the periphery of Europe was, of course, German profits, which had to go somewhere, since they were not being spent in Germany because the growth rate of Germany was being kept low. So we had this amazing situation between 2000 and 2008 where the periphery was growing faster than Germany on borrowed money, on money that was flowing into our countries from both Wall Street and Frankfurt. When in 2008, the pyramid of private toxic money created by Wall Street, the City and Frankfurt burned into ashes and collapsed under the weight of its own hubris, then, like a vicious tide, this capital, just as fast as it had moved in, moved out, like capital usually does. Think of South Korea in 1998 or Thailand. And then we had a liquidity crisis, which very quickly created an insolvency crisis in the most fragile parts of the Union, Greece being the case in point. Once we reached that stage, and once, as George said, the Greek crisis was being treated by the Eurozone as a Greek crisis, as opposed to a systemic Eurozone crisis. And the medicine delivered was one of liquidation and shrinkage. The domino effect was bound to happen, precisely as it did in the 1929 to 1932-33 period, destroying the common currency of that era. Germany's refusal today to consider even the minimum steps that need to be taken in order to reverse this process of deconstruction of the Eurozone is not stubbornness, it's not an error, it's a straightforward application and dedication to the principles that built the Eurozone. The Eurozone was not an exercise in creating a federation or a common European home. It was an exercise, if I'm right in my hypothesis, in maintaining a model by which German corporations globalized on the basis of aggregate demand imported from the Eurozone. The Maastricht Treaty was essential for not creating a surplus recycling mechanism, the kind of recycling mechanism that would be necessary in order to save the Eurozone now. So in a sense, I completely and utterly understand Germany's commitment to not allowing the creation of a surplus recycling mechanism within the Eurozone. The tragedy is that by not allowing it, the Eurozone is doomed. Every single discussion in Europe, and this is my last sentence, about fiscal unions and banking unions, if you look very carefully at the way in which German officials are describing them, you will find that this is just cheap talk, the purpose of which is to confirm the whole talk about more Europe, more in the breach than in the observance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Yanis. I think that the beauty of what we are going to have tonight is that the three of us have been on the ground in a number of ways and in two different angles. You've heard the story of the last 30 years. During those 30 years, Marshall was in investment management, so I think it would be very interesting to find out from him, when you lived through that, how do you invest? But he's also, as I told you, an academic. He's a researcher at the Levy Institute at Bard College, research fellow for economics and peace and security, and he just became director of the institutional partnerships for the Institute of New Economic Thinking. So we'll have a combination, again, of points of view, and then we'll start debating it.
Probably a collaboration of points of view, since I don't have anything that's distinctly different from what Jana said. I know that economists, generally speaking, cannot resist using visual aids, but in contrast to most, I'm not going to use any mathematical equations or a bunch of Greek letters. I'm going to draw from popular culture and start with this YouTube clip from the film Misery, because I think it's a perfect metaphor for what is being experienced in Europe right now. So watch this.
Okay, there we go. Now you know why I never use too much.